for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Under the new health care law that Congress passed in March, insurers will be more tightly regulated and millions more Americans will be covered. But many people are not sure how it will affect them. And there is some confusion about health insurance exchanges, rules on pre-existing conditions, changes to Medicare and Medicaid. Joining me in the studio to explain what these new laws are going to mean for you, Mary Agnes Carey of Kaiser Health News, Alec McGillis of The Washington Post, and Susan Dentzer of Health Affairs. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning, Diane.
Mary Agnes, give us an overview of what has to be done now to implement the various provisions in the new health care bill.
One of the most immediate provisions that will be implemented as early as June is the high-risk pool for people that can't get health insurance in other places. States had to tell the Secretary of Health and Human Services whether or not they would participate. They had to let that be known by the end of April. 29 states and the District of Columbia had said that they will participate in a high-risk pool, and 18 states said that they would not. Other provisions will take effect. They were scheduled to take effect in about 6 months, but they're moving up earlier for a variety of reasons. For example, the administration said yesterday they would implement earlier a program to help companies cover the costs of their early retirees. These are folks who retire at age 55, but they can't qualify for Medicare yet until they're 65, so the government will step in and help with those to a certain level. Also, insurers have come forth and said they will implement provisions earlier, like rescissions. Those are going back and canceling health insurance once someone gets sick, most often for a reason that's completely unrelated to whatever they're being treated for. Insurers have said they will move to do that now. They also will move earlier to implement a provision that would allow you to keep children on your policy until age 26 if they can't qualify for coverage from an employer or somewhere else. So those are things that the insurance companies are moving to do right away. And of course, we can't leave out the Department of Health and Human Services, which is writing all the rules and regulations, and they're very busy trying to get those rules set so these provisions can be implemented.
One of the aspects of this I'm particularly interested in is rescission. And Alec McGillis, you're not only a reporter for The Washington Post, you're co-author of a new book titled Landmark, The Inside Story of America's New Healthcare Law and What It Means for Us All. Explain that rescission provision.
Well, as Mary Agnes said, it's really companies find excuses to cancel people's policies once they've actually gotten sick.
And these, like what?
Well, there'll be things that are completely unrelated often. They'll just be things in their application. When you apply to get your insurance, you'll maybe wrote down that you had this or that health issue. If you wrote in something that they find, that they go back and find to have been even minimally somehow inaccurate, they can cancel your policy, even if it has nothing to do with this illness that you've now sought claims for.
So what does this new law mean?
This law basically, this is one of the things that was eliminated immediately or within 6 months. This is going to be, by September, companies are moving this up now, but by September, this is something you're no longer going to be able to do. This was seen as such a controversial practice that insurers, basically agreed to do this pretty much right off the bat.
And Susan Dentzer, this gets tricky because it's how you define a mistake or a failure or a particular word.
Right. And insurance companies still have the ability to rescind your coverage if you've committed fraud. For example, if you're actively being treated for cancer and you lied about that and said you're perfectly healthy and they can prove that you lied about it, then they can rescind it because that is fraudulent. You just lied to the company. This is, first of all, it's important to say this applies mainly, rescissions have applied mainly only in the individual health insurance market. If you're getting coverage through an employer in a large group, this doesn't happen. You don't get your coverage pulled back like this. But for individuals who are applying and purchasing coverage on the individual market, who have to be so-called medically underwritten, you have to write in everything that you've ever suffered from, et cetera, if you have been in any way dishonest about it, insurers can still rescind your policy. However, as Alex says, if you, for example, neglected to point out to somebody that maybe you were taking birth control pills 20 years ago, they might decide that they're not going to cover you for something else. And this is where it's gotten very tricky. People have felt that what's happening is insurers are going out of their way to cancel any policies that will amount to any risk at all that they'll have to pay out on claims.
Susan Dancer, she's editor-in-chief of Health News and on-air analyst on health issues for PBS's The NewsHour with Jim Lehrer. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Mary Agnes, you've talked about some of the provisions that are going to take place right away. Talk about the adults with pre-existing conditions. How does this new law affect them?
Well, starting in, I believe that is in 2014, that if you have a pre-existing medical condition, you can't be denied coverage for it, nor could they deny renewal of your health insurance.
I mean, are we talking about chronic conditions? Are we talking about surgical procedures?
Everything. Of 2014, this is a monumental shift in the nature of the individual and the small group insurance market. As I said earlier, in an employer market, everybody has always been in the pool. If you work for a large company, you get insurance no matter what is wrong with you. In the individual market where you're buying it on your own or in a small group, a small business, basically insurers will price their policies based on whether you're sick already, how many people in the pool are sick, et cetera. This is all going to change. We're going to move to a system where everybody is in the insurance pool. If you're sick, if you're healthy, et cetera. You'll be charged different rates depending on if you're older versus younger, but people cannot, your coverage cannot be priced differently based on whether you are sick or not. And that is a monumental shift that will take place in 2014. As Mary Agnes said, we start to go down the road immediately with the availability of these new high-risk pools or the federal high-risk pool that will be created.
Alan.
And this is really kind of where the individual mandate comes in. In a sense, there's a deal that was made with the insurers. They're going to have to take all the customers that want to buy policies from them. At the same time, we're going to mandate that people get coverage so that the healthy younger people who maybe haven't had coverage until now are also going to be going into the pool. That way, the insurers get a bigger pool that helps them basically afford to pay for people who might have conditions or are older. It's sort of a two-way deal, and in a sense, it's also a three-way deal that we've made here because we're also going to be helping people to purchase insurance. So it's sort of a three-legged stool. You have to get insurance. Insurers have to take you when you come to buy a policy, and we're going to help you buy insurance, afford insurance if you're of a lower income.
And isn't there a penalty if you do not have insurance?
Yes, indeed. The penalty starts very small in 2014. I believe it's $95, and it phases up. It's not as high as many insurers would have liked. They don't think it's a big enough stick to get everybody in the pool. But nonetheless, it's going to be significant. I think it's around $695, if I recall correctly, at the high end, although it also could be a percentage of your family income, which could arguably be higher.
You know, we talked about pre-existing conditions for adults, but for children, that happens right away, does it not?
That's right, it does. And there was some debate about the way the law was written, whether insurers would have to do that immediately or not, but they've said now that they will do that. And again, it's one of those issues where it's gotten a lot of attention, a lot of focus, and moving it for children right away is something that they've agreed to do, the insurers.
There's one other provision that I think is important to an awful lot of people, that is that your children can stay on your health insurance until, what is it, Alec, age 26?
Right, your 26th birthday, and it's not through 26, it's through,
not
through 25.
Through 26,
so better,
okay.
Better get something else when you turn 26.
How much help is that? Actually,
it's going to be a great deal of help. And in fact, the reason that so many insurers have come forward now and announced that they're going to do it right away is it's really a good faith effort to try to insure people who are about to graduate from college and move off, say, a college's health insurance policy or something that they bought as a student and potentially go into the labor force or not, given the current economy, and therefore become uninsured. So the fact that these folks could now move back onto their parents' policy as of May or June, whenever they graduate, is an important step that suggests that insurers really are now wanting to – everybody's moving to this new situation where everybody's going to be in the pool and everybody's going to be covered.
You know, there's been an awful lot made of this bill. On the one hand, you've heard people say it's nothing, it doesn't do anything. On the other hand, some people have said, oh, it goes too far. What do you think, Alec?
Well, it's a very interesting paradox in a sense that you just touched on. I mean, we're in this funny lull right now with this bill. We had this whole Sturm und Drang about the debate this past year, and then the bill passes, and actually quite little happens. And because most of the major provisions aren't happening until 2014. So on the one hand, you could say, well, the people who were, you know, sort of hysterical about this bill, that looks a little bit silly now. And the president actually said, you know, after the bill passed, you know, where's Armageddon? Everyone's been warning about Armageddon, and I don't see Armageddon.
But on
the other hand, you know, where are the benefits? People might be wondering, where are all these benefits? What was the whole point of this whole debate?
And that's what we're talking about today. Alec McGillis is a reporter for The Washington Post, Mary Agnes Carey with Kaiser Health News, Susan Dentzer of Health News. Stay with us. Welcome back. We're talking about various questions concerning the new health care law that President Obama signed into law. And since then, many people have questions about precisely what's in it, when it comes into play, and so on. One other question before we open the phones, and that's about the so-called donut hole. People have been faced with this gap in how their drugs are paid for, how much they were paid, and then the so-called donut hole. Mary Agnes, what does this bill do for that?
Starting this year, when you hit the donut hole, and again, we're talking about that's at about $3,600 this year of drug costs. Once you hit that, you get a $250 check from the government. You don't have to do anything. You don't have to take any action. HHS, the Department of Health and Human Services, has been very clear about that. Over time, over the next 10 years to 2020, they want to phase out the donut hole. and so it will no longer exist.
Okay, and this is simply for people on Medicare.
Right, who are in this Medicare prescription drug program.
Okay.
Yes.
Right.
There's one other benefit, too, that starts next year, which is that once you hit the donut hole, you're able to buy brand name prescription drugs for half of the cost. Huh. The pharmaceutical manufacturers have agreed to discount drugs for their branded drugs for people in the donut hole. Now, many people are taking generic drugs anyway, so it doesn't matter. But if you're taking a brand drug, you'll pay half price for it.
Do you think that generic drugs are always as good as brand name drugs?
Well, a very stunning result of the passage of the Medicare Drug Coverage Act was that millions and millions of people have moved off of brand name medications to the generic form. And, you know, frankly, nobody's dying because of it. So far, so good. I think we've shown that we have a very robust generic drug market in this country, and it's saving a lot of people a lot of money.
All right. Here are some messages from Facebook. From Barbara, is there any expectation that the cost of insurance for us with pre-existings will come down? Although my so-called pre-existing condition is very mild, I've never been treated for it in the 13 years since it was noted on my chart. I pay the same rates as my same-age friend with diabetes, hypertension, obesity, and gastroesophageal reflux disease. Will any of us see any decrease in these steep premiums, Susan?
Well, the answer is it depends. In essence, because everybody will be in the pool, we'll be spreading the cost of the sick across a larger group of people. Some people may be surprised to know that about 50% of all the medical spending we have in this country is traceable to about 5% of people, 5% of very sick people. So we're going to be spreading those costs across a much broader pool because more people will be buying insurance, including younger people, as Alex said earlier. So that's going to tend to lower premiums for everybody relative to the current situation. On the other hand, there are going to be new benefits packages that will be available to people. And what the components of those will be decided over the next several years. And the packages are going to be pretty good and fairly generous, although priced differently within exchanges. So netting all of this out, are your premiums going to go up or down? We don't know. The odds are, and the Congressional Budget Office said, many people are going to end up with more generous health benefits out of this because they'll get covered under these new, more generous policies. And the act of spreading the costs across more people will tend to depress the price. But we will have to see, honestly, how this plays out.
All right. There is another very basic question. Many of these provisions, as you've all said, don't go into effect until 2014, which is after the next presidential election. How great is the possibility that this whole health care reform bill might be thrown out, Alec?
Well, that prospect of that is probably fairly minimal. Republicans, you know, would love to do that, but
and they say they will.
But you have to keep in mind that they would have to win the White House for starters, because otherwise they'd be looking at a veto.
Right.
So they would have to with President Obama in office, they would not only have to win a majority in Congress, they would have to win veto-proof majorities if they were to override his veto. But there's still obviously a lot of threats along those lines. I think that the bigger political challenge for the bill is going to be the implementation of the bill, because you have so much of this bill is going to be implemented by the states. These new marketplaces where people are going to buy insurance are going to be set up on a state-by-state or maybe regional basis. And so if you have states where the political leadership is very opposed to this bill, why would they try hard to make it work? That's going to be a huge challenge. In Massachusetts, when they set up their version of this bill a couple years ago, they had a political consensus around what they were doing. Republicans, including Mitt Romney, were on board. And so everyone got together and tried to make this work. How's this going to work in Texas, where you have a governor who thinks that this is basically communism?
Haven't you already had states that have said, we can't afford this, we're not going to do it? then does it get challenged constitutionally?
Yeah, it will be challenged constitutionally. There are about, I think it's 18 states that have already filed lawsuits on the individual mandate. 18 states have said no thank you to running a high-risk pool. Now, the federal government has to step in and do it. But the same thing, I agree with Alec. I wonder what will happen with these states. There is a federal fallback provision in the bill that says if you're in a health insurance exchange, you don't have a couple of choices, that the Office of Personnel Management, OPM, will negotiate that for you. But if states dig their heels in and state legislatures say no thank you, this could really complicate implementation and hurt the Democrats.
And this really has a lot to do with the mandate. I mean, in Massachusetts, they had this whole kind of almost a propaganda campaign going to persuade people to buy insurance, to tell them you have to buy insurance. This is the right thing to do. They got everyone on board. They got the Red Sox involved. They had it was just everywhere, this message. But if you have a state in 2014 where the governor, where your own governor is basically saying that this mandate is outrageous and unconstitutional, it's just you're not going to have that same kind of persuasive campaign to get people to do this.
On the other hand, let's look at some factors of reality here. For example, to pick up more people under Medicaid. Usually Medicaid and the federal government and the states split the cost of Medicaid. And the federal government
remind us that's for low-income adults and
children.
That's
right. And we're going to expand the Medicaid program and the number of people eligible for that program under the law. Usually the federal government pays about two-thirds of the cost of covering somebody under Medicaid, and on average states pay about a third. Well, for this new population that will be brought into Medicaid, the federal government pays 100% of the money for a while, and then it phases down, but to a point where it's still picking up most of the money to cover this population. So if a governor wants to have all of this repealed, he or she essentially has to say, we're not going to take that money from the federal government to cover all of these people in our state who are arguably suffering because they don't have health insurance. So it will set up an interesting dynamic when all of this rolls out.
But you could have a governor say, that federal money is for the expanded population, my new population. It doesn't help my current existing Medicaid rolls. And I agree with Susan's point. It's kind of hard to say to your voters, we have some help from the federal government we're not going to take. But if the politics are in favor of not taking it, they may go that route as well.
All right. What are the other aspects of this legislation that we really ought to talk about before we open the phone, Susan?
Well, I think it's important for people to understand the mechanism of how these exchanges might theoretically operate. And I would say it's also important to stress a point Alec made, which is that the way this law is written, if states decide not to do things, the federal government can step in. So, for example, if you're out in a state that decides it's not going to set up an exchange, you'll be able to buy coverage through the federal exchange, and there will be new national health insurance plans available.
How do you do that? How do you actually go about buying through an exchange?
Well, people should think about, most people have shopped for travel, say, on Travelocity or a site like that. Exchanges for most people are going to be websites. In fact, the exchange now in Massachusetts is a website. You can Google it. It's the MassachusettsConnectorAuthority.com, I believe. You call up the website. You enter information about your age, where you live, what kind of policy you want. And basically, the website is on Travelocity. Once you've said, I want to fly to Vegas on Tuesday, Travelocity will feed out a bunch of options for you. Same thing would happen. You'd get a bunch of different options. Here are the packages you're eligible for. If you want the bronze plan, here's what it would cost. If you want the platinum plan, here's what it would cost. And here's what the different insurance companies would charge you for that.
Can you do that across state lines, or must it be within your own state?
Well, this is where it will get interesting. The states are allowed to get together and form a regional exchange. They can have a regional compact where they could allow, Massachusetts could allow people in Connecticut to buy plans.
Will that lower costs?
Arguably, it will. And then there's also there will be new national health insurance plans available that people will be able to pick from. So in theory, just the way most people will say that the effect of having, say, Travelocity or Expedia has been, it's lowered the price because It's made the pricing very transparent for people. You know exactly what Southwest wants to charge you versus what United wants to charge you.
Right.
And you can comparison shop. And arguably, that phenomenon will come into play, and people will be able to comparison shop among a bunch of very clear benefits packages with very clear price tags attached to them.
How soon?
That's what goes into effect in 2014, officially. But another point is, this isn't rocket science to set this up. Massachusetts managed to get this done within a year. So now that this is in law, we can expect that some states are going to move forward more quickly and begin to set this up. Now, the subsidies from the federal government to help you pay for this will probably not come into effect till 2014, but there's no reason the exchanges can't start forming before that.
Now, Alec, do you think that people across the country hearing about these various options are going to be willing to move more quickly than the politicians within their own states?
You mean people
just taking what Susan just said, acknowledging that they had these options that they didn't know about, is that going to perhaps make them feel more favorably about
right.
this legislation?
Well, that's really the big question in a sense. And the one issue, of course, is that for so many people, very little will change for quite some time.
If you have your own insurance. Yeah.
We are really this bill, in a sense, really was about people without coverage and people who are out in this wild west right now of getting their own coverage on the open market, which is in a lot of places kind of a scary thing to do. So I think people who have been in that wild west and know how rough it is to operate on your own in this very untransparent and very expensive world of buying insurance on your own, they will. Be very sensitive to these improvements in their situation, and they will start to see that this is a better world for them.
Alec McGill is at the Washington Post. He's co-author of Landmark, the Inside Story of America's New Healthcare Law and What It Means for All of Us. And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. We're going to open the phones 800-433-8850. I know we have many, many people who'd like to be part of the program, both here in the United States and abroad. We're going to actually go to Helsinki, Finland first, to Osmo. Good morning. You're on the air. And I gather for you it's about 5:30 in the afternoon.
Good morning. Thank you for letting me in.
Certainly.
My sort of little quandary is, having looked a little bit both at the United States and the healthcare system in my home country, Finland. You know, the systems, I think, are comparable. In Finland, the life expectancy is somewhat higher and the infant mortality rate is lower, and both countries operate open heart surgery and what have you. However, in Finland, everybody has sort of unlimited health insurance. Yet the cost of healthcare in Finland is about 8% of gross national product, whereas in the United States it's about 16%. That makes me wonder why.
That is a question that lawmakers have been asking, and people in administration, as they look at this bill, why do we spend so much and get worse outcomes than many other countries, including Finland, around the world? And so that's why, while some of this bill goes into effect in different provisions at different dates, there is a strategy, I think, overall. They're trying to make Medicare, for example, a more efficient payer. The individual mandate is geared to getting more people covered. The health insurance exchanges are geared to provide people more choices to get them covered. There's a lot of ways they're getting at inefficiencies that they hope will produce a more efficient system for everyone.
Yeah.
And a lot of these provisions really are about reducing the overutilization of healthcare in this country. There's a sense that we order too many tests, we order too many treatments that are sort of wasteful or duplicative. So there's a lot in the bill in that direction. What what a lot of people worry about is that there's not enough done in the bill to really kind of reduce the price that we pay for health care. That was one of the arguments for the public, the so-called public option, that the government would have basically more purchasing power when it came to health care, and that we'd be paying lower rates, lower prices to medical providers, which is why doctors and hospitals were very, very opposed to that.
But, Susan, could this in some way be interpreted as a first step toward a public option?
Well, there is a possibility for states to set up something that looks like a public option. It's called the basic health plan that they could set up for lower income people. So there's that possibility. There's also this new nationally available health insurance plan, at least one of which will have to be a nonprofit. So that's not strictly speaking a public option, but it's going to look a lot like a public option. I think just to get back to Alex's point, about half of the if you look at U.S. health spending, we spend on a per-person basis about half as much, again, as the next biggest spender, which in any given year is going to be usually Luxembourg or Switzerland. And about of that amount that we spend extra, about half of that is due to the fact that we pay higher prices for everything. We pay our doctors more, we pay our hospitals more, et cetera. So one question will be how much of this price, excess prices, we'll be able to squeeze out of our system. Then there's the part about getting rid of all the stuff that we don't really need.
Osmo, thank you for your call. And that was Susan Dentzer. She's editor-in-chief of Health Affairs and on-air analyst on health issues for PBS's The News Hour. Short break, right back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University, by the German Embassy and the German Information Center, whose Germany.info publishes news and politics, culture and lifestyle at Germany.info, by the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness, on the web at MelvilleTrust.org, and by the Kiplinger Foundation, supporting public understanding of business and the economy. This is NPR.
Isabel Allende on why she chose slavery as the subject of her new historical novel. It's the story of an orphan mulatta who travels from pre-revolutionary Haiti to French-controlled New Orleans. The Diane Rehm Show. Next hour. And now let's take a call from Concord, New Hampshire. Good morning, Robert. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. Thank you for hearing my question.
Surely.
I work for a company that offers health insurance, but the rub is that the health insurance has a $5,000 deductible before copays kick in. To me, that's catastrophic insurance. My question is two. One is, am I going to be forced to accept this insurance? And two, can we expect insurers to be offering this kind of a plan in the future to to save money. Essentially, they'll never have to pay out unless you have a heart attack or something.
I think depending on the size of his employer, if the employer is not going into the health insurance exchange to provide other options, this gentleman would also not be allowed to purchase health insurance on the health insurance exchanges. So this is kind of an interesting point, because a key selling point of this bill for the president and for proponents has been that we won't disrupt your current health insurance. If you like your current plan, you can keep it. Well, this gentleman doesn't like his current plan and doesn't want to keep it,
right.
But he might be stuck with it. Now, as far as his catastrophic...
Wait a minute. Why is he stuck with it?
Because they took great caution. They did not, they being Democrats and the president, when they wrote the bill, they did not want to disrupt the employer-based system. So they put in firewalls, if you will, constraints on who can go in the exchange and who can't. It's generally limited to small employers, to individuals who don't have coverage. So that, to me, is the question I'd want to know.
And the size of his company is very important, because if it's a small business, the small businesses, as of this year, it's another thing that we didn't talk about that happens immediately. Small businesses are eligible for tax credits.
Being defined as?
Well, that's a complicated definition. It's
25 or fewer.
Or fewer.
And it's up for wages up to $50,000.
Robert, how large is your company?
My company is probably a couple of thousand throughout the United States.
Okay, well then this would not apply in your case. However, your company is probably going to take a look at what else is available on the marketplace for comparably placed people in 2014, and adjust its benefits package. I would guess is probably likely. The other thing is, if there is a provision in the bill that depending on your income. If you're being asked to contribute too much of your income to the premium, you get a voucher from your company that you can take and go buy a policy through the exchange.
I see.
So we'll have to see how all of this gels over the next few years.
Okay. Good luck to you, Robert. And now to Deborah in Charlotte, North Carolina. You're on the air.
Hi, this is Debbie from Charlotte. I'm 64 years old, and I'm on Blue Cross and Blue Shield for several years. I have a pre-existing condition. I am very unhappy with the cost and coverage. It's got a $2,500 deductible, and I can't even afford to use it. But I'm really afraid to drop it. It takes up half my income, and they just sent me a notice. They're raising it as of June 1st, $70 a month to $567. I can't afford to pay it. Can I drop it and be uninsured and pick up new coverage as of June 1st that I can afford?
Well, let's think this through. The problem with the high-risk pool is, to be eligible for the high-risk pool in June, you have to have not had health insurance for 6 months. So even if you've dropped your health insurance, you're not going to qualify for that. The other thing we don't know about the high-risk pool is how much this is going to cost. If I remember correctly, the out-of-pocket deductible for that high-risk pool is about $5,900. That's pretty high. Now, that's not as high as the deductible, the $2,500 that you are facing. I would not encourage you to drop health insurance under any circumstances, because one, heaven forbid, traffic accident, a cancer diagnosis, and you're really going to be in trouble.
And you're also, it sounds like, a year away from qualifying for Medicare. You're 64, you said, in which case I would say hang on and buy a decent Medicare product as soon as you can.
Okay, well, I'll beg, borrow, and steal to do that.
All right. Thanks for calling to John in Oswego, New York. Good morning to you. Oh, dear. Let's see if we can get to John. Good morning. You're on the air.
What?
Yes. Go right ahead, John.
Okay. It is my understanding, I'm not positive on this, that Congress has outstanding $45 trillion loaned somewhere as IOUs owed to the Medicare program. This will probably never be repaid to the taxpayers, who money comes out of their paychecks. Yet the American people don't even know where the money went. The United States is in severe financial trouble. Therefore, this is my question. If this plan is not defeated, is there a lockbox on the new plan so that these dollars cannot be used for any other purpose?
Susan.
There is no lockbox. Medicare, like Social Security, is a pay-as-you-go program, And the dollars that are collected every year through the payroll tax go right out the door to pay benefits to the current beneficiaries. I think what the caller is asking about is the fact that there are Medicare insurance trust funds. One covers hospital payments. Another covers the outpatient part of Medicare. But really, what those are accounting entries on the books of the federal government, where indeed, as benefits are collected or dollars are collected through taxes, benefits are paid out, and essentially one part of the government writes the other part of the government the IOU. So this is basically a promise that we're going to keep the program going and pay it over time. Now, under the law, essentially, we've extended the lifespan of at least one of the trust funds, which is the Hospital Insurance Trust Fund. So arguably, it's in better shape. But the caller's ultimate point is Medicare is a fiscal problem for the nation, and that is accurate. And we will probably see more steps to change the Medicare program coming out of the currently impaneled fiscal commission, because over time we are going to have to adjust the program.
How soon is that fiscal commission likely to issue a report?
After the election, the midterm election.
Indeed. All right, to Carol in Tulsa, Oklahoma, you're on the air.
Yes, I live in Oklahoma. And my question is, I have a daughter that turned 21 in January and lost her insurance. So we were thrilled when we found out that the bill had passed. She has a medical condition. One of her prescriptions costs $250 a month, and she just cannot afford it. And my question is, our state has been trying to work to sue the government to not participate in this program. And I know our attorney general has said he feels that it's a moot point, that it would be a waste of money. And the legislature is moving forward. I know it's passed one of the houses already to go ahead and sue. My question is, if that happens and the provision about being 26 and being able to be on your insurance till that time, will we lose that also?
I don't believe you will, because I'm sure the lawsuit's over the individual mandate, and that's going to be litigated for a long, long time. Mm. There'll be a lot of court challenges. Mm. I think keeping your daughter on your policy until she's 26 would remain.
That's right. I mean, what the lawsuits all involve are the individual mandate provision, not the entirety of the bill.
All right. What about these constitutional questions? And that is in part the grounds on which many of these states are going to fight this bill, isn't it?
It is, exactly. But there are members of Congress that say they feel it's well within their constitutional power to have an individual mandate. And there are states that say, no, you don't have the authority to get in and regulate. I think the term is the interstate commerce.
Right, interstate commerce and taxation. Yeah. And since they're sort of staking it on the power of the federal government both to regulate interstate commerce.
I see.
And in a sense, it also comes from the power to tax. In a sense, the mandate is a tax. It's a tax, you know, charged to people who don't have insurance.
All right. To St. Louis, Missouri. Good morning, Ali.
Good morning. I had a quick question. People that are at the age of 60 that are retired, but then they're not, you know, eligible for Medicare, is there a provision in this plan for those people? And I'm in specific inquiring because my father is in that situation. He recently retired, and, you know, he has pre-existing conditions, but unfortunately, insurance plans are, you know, either companies are refusing him insurance or they're just way too high for him to pay. So will it be possible for him to get something starting this summer?
He could theoretically buy coverage through a high-risk pool in all likelihood. It depends, of course, on how that coverage ends up being priced, et cetera, and what the rules are. And as Mary Agnes said, I always call her Mary Alice because I had a dear friend.
It's a beautiful name.
It's gorgeous. She doesn't take it. She's not hurt by it. Thank God. Anyway, as Mary Agnes said, there is this restriction that says you have to have been uninsured for a certain period of time. So if he is able to comply with that, he would be able to buy the coverage.
But it's temporary. Correct.
Well, temporary until 2014, right. At which point he'd have the access to the insurance through the exchanges, although it sounds like he'd be very close to being Medicare eligible at that point.
By then. Okay. Does that answer it, Ali?
I'm sorry. Can you say that again?
Does that answer your question?
Yes, it does.
Okay.
It does. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Bye. And let's go now to Fort Walton, Florida. Good morning, David.
Yes, good morning, Dan. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a good question. It's kind of a, I guess, a layman question. But I recently heard, actually, I think it was on MSNBC, they were talking about how the insurance industry is apparently exempt from antitrust and monopoly laws. Specifically, I think it was the Sherman Act. And I just kind of see how this would play in the whole exchange setup that, you know, the administration is going to be putting up. And if there is actually going to be a change to that, perhaps, and maybe if you have some more insight, or your guests may have more insight on this act, perhaps.
You're right. The insurance industry is exempt from antitrust. There's a separate bill that was debated this past year to take away that exemption. It passed the House by a very wide margin, and it's unclear what's going to happen to it in the Senate. There's some debate, though, whether that taking away that exemption would have all that much impact on the industry. The real hope is that simply having these exchanges is going to just bring a whole new level of competition to the insurance market. Right now, you have states where the individual insurance market is dominated by, you know, one or two companies and that have a really kind of a near quasi-monopoly. And so the hope is that by setting up these new marketplaces that you're going to bring a whole bunch of new players into the game and possibly solve the problem that way.
Alec McGillis, he's a reporter for The Washington Post, co-author of Landmark, The Inside Story of America's New Healthcare Law, What It Means for Us All. And you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Here is an email, let's see, from Myra, who says, what does the new medical health insurance bill do for those of us who'd like to purchase a Medicare supplement plan? I've not purchased one because I cannot afford it. However, I'll be up a creek if I become seriously ill, even with Medicare paying 80%. Will there be any cost breaks for people like me? Mary.
We don't believe that the bill does deal with the Medicare supplemental provisions, but one potential option for your viewer, listener, is to get into a Medicare Advantage plan. Now, these are these private plans in Medicare that cover all the medical costs, drugs, and doctor visits and hospital visits versus the traditional fee-for-service plan that she's in. But one thing to know is that Congress is reducing reimbursements to Medicare Advantage plans, which could cut out some of their extra benefits like eyeglasses, hearing aids, and gym memberships. So she needs to keep her eye on those factors as well.
All right. And to Healdsburg, California. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning. Thank you. What a prediction. Do you know what will happen to the payments to like small hospitals to physicians? You know, we're due for a 21% cut in October and other healthcare providers. What are your thoughts on payments to healthcare providers?
Well, Congress is still grappling with what to do with the physician fee cut in Medicare. There are various proposals so far. Obviously, that's been delayed for several months now and likely will be going forward. The question is how you fix it permanently, and that's the one that Congress is still trying to hash out. So what we're fairly confident in saying is there probably won't be a 21% fee cut, but what will replace it isn't clear at the moment. On the question of payments to small hospitals, all hospitals agree to give up a larger rate of increase that they would have been eligible for over the next several years as a way to help finance this entire program. So hospitals usually get an adjustment. It's called an update that increases what they're paid through Medicare. They're going to get a smaller update year by year through this. So hospitals are going to feel some financial pressure. Again, they hope that's going to be offset by the fact that we'll have so many more people insured, and therefore hospitals will essentially be able to treat people who will now have insurance to pay for it.
All right. I want to take one last quick call from Reston, Virginia. Karen, you're on the air. Quickly, please.
Hi. I'm self-employed, and I've bought insurance on the open market for many years. I'm in my fourth year now of treatment for breast cancer. I'm doing well. I'm still working more than full time, but they've raised my rates 500% since I was diagnosed, and I simply cannot pay anymore. I don't know if I can hold on till 2014 or if I would be helped then. Do I have any recourse?
Wow.
You don't, in the sense that you wouldn't be eligible for the high-risk pool because you've had coverage. I think that you will start to see some more restraint on insurance companies raising premiums, although how much more restraint remains to be seen. As you well know, many insurers earlier this year were announcing increases on the individual market on the order of 39% or so, which indicates really they had lost control of the market. So we don't know how quickly that will be stabilized.
There is a provision going to effect in January that's going to basically limit the extent to which insurers can jack up rates in the individual market. So Susan's right. You might be seeing less of that.
And quickly.
She said she's self-employed. See if she can qualify for tax credit to help pay for her coverage.
Karen, I hope those are ideas you'll pursue. I'm sorry you've experienced your situation. Good luck to you. Mary Agnes Carey, Alec McGillis, Susan Dentzer, thank you so much. As time goes on and we hear and learn more and more about this, I think we'll devote a two-hour segment to answering people's questions. Thanks for being here. Thanks for listening, all. I'll be off for the next few days, going to Grandparents' Day in Boston. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.